Okay, so I've written down some references on nearby cycles. So these are kind of the two canonical sources where everything that I said is actually proved. But these other two things are kind of more introductory, and this is a book which contains a lot of proofs as well in a pretty good way. So I recommend those. Okay, so now let me recall what we were doing. So I was in the middle of sort of a calculation which we need. So what we want to do is sort of calculate the semi-simple Lefschetz number, which by definition is this sum, well, I mean, not by definition, but by the Lefschetz fixed-point theorem, it's the sum over fp to the j rational points in the Schmoor variety, semi-simple trace Frobenius on the nearby cycles, the stalks of the nearby cycles. And what we wanted to explain was this way to express this number as a sum of orbital integrals. So it's in fact going to be a kind of double sum over various group elements, some volume term, and then there's going to be an orbital integral of a particular function, and then a twisted orbital integral of another function. And then the point was that that's good, because then after some further work, you can express that as a sum over automorphic representations of trace pi on related functions. So there'll be a function, the same function here away from p, some other function at p that's related to this one, and then the sum function at infinity. Okay, so now, before I say anything more, the fact is that I want to explain what's the general nature of this expression here. So what kind of functions we're looking, both for the functions we need to plug in here and to prove that there's an identity. So what kind of functions arise? Well, if an automorphic representation, which can, you remember, can always be written as a kind of tensor product of irreducible representations of the groups at the local places, if that contributes to the right-hand side, then it's a fact that you have to have certain fixed vectors. So the representation here, which is a representation of the finite adelic points of the group away from P, that has to have fixed vectors under K upper P, which was the compact open subgroup we fixed originally. So this has to be non-zero. And also, the representation at P has to have fixed vectors under the parahoric. So I won't justify that, because in some sense, it will come out in the end that that these things are true. But I mean, you can justify these, so to speak, a priori if you think about it the right way. And what this means is that this function here, well, it has parahoric fixed vectors. Therefore, it's what's called an unramified principal series representation. So for those familiar with representation theory, that's a particularly nice kind of representation. So at the prime P, we don't get arbitrary representations that are going to come in here, only very special ones. And in the good reduction case, when P is a prime over which you have a prime in the reflex field where the Schmoor variety has good reduction, then you even have a stronger thing, that the only representations here will have fixed vectors under the maximal compact, which is an even better situation. Those things are called spherical representations. So these you get when you study the problem with parahoric level structure at P, you get a slightly more general kind of representation that can intervene on the spectral side. Okay, but a consequence of this is that these functions here have to lie in particular Heck algebras. So the trace, remember, the trace of pi, the tensor product evaluated on these functions, is just the product of the traces. So all three of those have to be non-zero in order for this to contribute. And therefore, this implies that the function that we're going to be looking for here is going to be in the Heck algebra of k upper p bi-invariant functions. And the function that we look for, this function here is going to depend on this one in some way I'm not going to describe now. But right, this function here is going to be some function on the p-adic group, and it's going to have to be, in order to have a non-zero trace on representations of this type, it has to be bi-invariant with respect to that case of p. So we have to be looking for functions that are in these Heck algebras. So these are Heck algebras under a convolution where you choose Haar measures, in some way. Okay, so these things are sometimes called parahoric Heck algebras. And that's more general than the word spherical Heck algebra, which has been used before. It hasn't come up so much, but anyway, it's a common word. And at the other extreme, that's the maximal kind of parahoric subgroup. You could have a maximal compact, but you can also have the Ewell-Hori, which is sort of the other extreme, and then you get an Ewell-Hori Heck algebra. And the structure of all these algebras is pretty much known. So it's sort of helpful that we're looking for a function in a kind of known algebra. Okay, so let me remind you that if you have GL2, then we have very little choice for our parahorics here. So that means that there's basically only two standard parahorics. Okay, so one thing is the maximal compact. This is one standard guy. And the other one is the matrices that look like the following. You have matrices that, when you reduce mod p, they're integral zp coefficients, but when you reduce mod p, you get something upper triangular. So this would, I'll often just denote this by I and call it Ewell-Hori. Okay, so basically, remember, the level structure here, this corresponds to good reduction at p. And here, we're going to get bad reduction. In other words, as I already stated before, but I haven't proved, that you do get singularities in the special fiber. In other words, we're going to really have singular variety when you reduce mod p in this case. Before I go further, I want to give you just a review of what's the structure theory of, let's look at the Heck algebras here, of these Heck algebras, okay? So one kind of Heck algebra, the spherical one, so for this discussion here, briefly, G is just any split group over a local field, and K is going to be just equal to maximal compact, which is just given by taking the integral points of G. So if you think of GL2 there, if you like. And then I will be the Ewell-Hori as above. I mean, there's a more general definition of Ewell-Hori, which I sort of gave last time for GLN and symplectic group, but this discussion works for every group and every kind of Ewell-Hori. And so recall that that the Heck algebra, I'm going to write G just for G of F. This is a convolution algebra. It has a basis, a C basis, given by characteristic functions of double cosets. And using Kawitz's notation in his lectures, you have this pi upper mu. So pi can be a uniformizer here. Pi upper mu, if mu is a co-character, you just evaluate the co-character at pi, that gives you something in some, say, maximal torus, which is contained inside the F points of the group. So you can just regard this as living inside the p-adic points of the group itself. And that one, that just means the characteristic function of that. Now, the Heck algebra, the Iwahori Heck algebra, now one other thing I should say is that this algebra is commutative. It's a finitely generated, I won't bother to say that, but it's just commutative algebra. Now this one has a C basis given by characteristic functions of double cosets that look like this, and now where W ranges over something called the extended affine vowel group. And, well, the way this can be realized as a group is by taking the co-characters of a maximal torus T, and the vowel group of T will act on that. And in fact, there'll be a semi-direct product with the finite vowel group, or the vowel group for T. Pardon? Yeah, in the extended affine vowel group. So this is a very big group. It's not just this finite group. It's got all these translation elements. And you can view these guys as living inside of G by taking, well, a finite vowel group element, it's like you can represent those by like permutation matrices for GLN. So you can embed those inside the group. And for translations, you do it the same way as you do here. So for example, mu will go to something like that. Okay, so in other words, in order to describe a function explicitly in this Heck algebra, you need to give an explicit linear combination of these things. And by the way, the reason this works is that something called the Bruhatitz decomposition. So G of F is a disjoint union over all elements looks like this. So this is just a general structure theory thing, which can be proved more or less by hand for the case of GLN. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is, with this in mind, we want to describe the functions. In the end, I'm going to state a theorem where those functions are going to be described explicitly in sort of this language. And I also want to mention that I don't want to give you the impression that what I'm doing here is somehow really special to bad reduction. Maybe it wasn't clear from my last lecture. So one of the parahorics is the maximal compact. The maximal compact corresponds to good reduction. So everything I'm doing in some sense for all parahorics at once means that one of the cases that's implicit in everything I'm doing is the good reduction case. So many people here probably don't care much about bad reduction. It only occurs at finitely many primes. But what I'm saying is that I'm basically going to give you the core argument that you need, even in the good reduction case, and just show that there's something similar that also works in this kind of slightly bad reduction case. So what we're going to do is we're going to fix, and pretty much most of the arguments, we're going to fix Kp to be the Iwahori, but the same methods, work for every parahoric, including the maximal parahoric, the maximal compact, the case of good reduction, where it's even easier. And moreover, I should say that in the good reduction case, if P is a prime of good reduction, then that weird semi-simple zeta function that I wrote down before is really it's really the thing the good reduction, normal zeta function that people study when they study good reduction. So I really am doing a generalization of what you need to do. And okay, so now let me state a theorem. So this is for the case of G equals GL2, and KP is the Iwahori, and the group away from P is the same one I gave before, but I'll denote it this way. So it's the, you take the integral points in the Adels away from P, and you impose the condition that G is congruent to 1 mod n. So that's a sort of a congruent subgroup. Of course, I'm assuming that n and p are coprime here, so I'm sort of putting level structure away from p there. And now, the theorem is that the semi-simple Lefschetz number can be written in the following way. So I'm going to explain explain these things as I go. So first there's the volume term, which will become clear what it is in the proof, and then there's this orbital integral, and the function that you put here is the characteristic function of this subgroup. And then you take a twisted orbital integral of a function I'm going to describe in a second, which is going to be in the Iwahori-Heck algebra. So let me just say a little bit more about what these things are. So these are elliptic, semi-simple elements. So these are things inside G of Q, so GL2Q, elliptic element, semi-simple, and up to conjugacy. Okay. Now, moreover, this element is some, this gamma is something in the Adelic points away from P, which is, you know, it can be written as sort of depending on, you give yourself an element in the group for every prime not equal to p, every finite prime. And what we impose is that, well, this element here is going to be conjugate in the group GQP prime for every prime not equal to p. So that's sort of an Adelic element. And delta is going to lie not in the group, but in some extension. So it's going to lie in this unramified extension, the unique unramified extension of degree j, and it has the property that the norm of delta, which is defined to be a certain expression, delta sigma of delta, blah, 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 sigma to the j minus 1 of delta, is conjugate in GQP, in GQPJ to gamma 0, where here sigma is an automorphism. I mean, it's the automorphism that takes x to the p, so that's a generator inside the Galois group, qp unramified mod qp, and so it acts. This automorphism acts on the p to the j points of the group, and this is what I mean when I write this down. I'm letting that automorphism act on the points of the group, and you form this product, and this is just called the norm of delta. And it means the unique, up to, you know, once you choose an algebraic closure of QP, there's a unique extension that's unramified of degree J inside there. So just call it that. Okay, now I have to define what the twisted orbital integral is and what the function C sub J is. And these twisted orbital integrals, they come up in the trace formula, and they come up in the fundamental lemma. And so hopefully Tom Hales will mention some more things about those. But they're fundamental objects, and my point today is just that they come up natural from the geometry in a natural way. Okay, so what is a twisted orbital integral? Well, you have a function phi, which is now a function on this extension, the group with values in this extension field, and what this is an integral over a sigma conjugacy class of delta. So what we have we sort of have this bigger p-adic group, and inside there we have kind of the stabilizer, the twisted stabilizer of delta, and then we write down. This is like the same way you form. This is exactly the same way you form orbital integrals, except for instead of just having conjugacy here, you have this kind of twisted version where over here you write sigma of g instead of just g. So here, this thing here is just the elements of the group. So it's the elements inside this extension field such that x inverse delta sigma of x is equal to delta. So it's this like conjugacy. It's just like the centralizer, except for it's a twisted centralizer. Okay, and here you have to choose a suitable measure on the quotient again. And anyway, that's what it is. And now the key thing is that this function phi sub j can be written as a function in the Ewald-Hori-Heck algebra. So that means I'm going to give you a linear combination of elements like this. And it turns out it's a very concrete thing. So you can write it out the following way. So this is something in the Heck algebra. So to speak, upstairs. It's in the Heck algebra over this unramified extension. So that means that the Ewald-Hori subgroup here, which I'll write I sub p to j, is actually the analogous kind of Ewald-Hori subgroup, but in the bigger field, in the bigger group rather than in the smaller one. So this is I'm going to give you double cosets with respect to this Ewald-Hori, but the Weyl group is unchanged. Okay, when you do that. I mean, you haven't changed, in some sense, either one of these objects right here when you pass to a bigger extension field. So I'm still going to give you, so to speak, double cosets, but I'm going to give you explicit matrices which are the representatives of certain elements in that thing. So what you have here is the double coset, which is given by the matrix P001 plus a certain coefficient, 1 minus P to the J, times another double coset, and then finally a third one. Okay, so this is just the function. It's got three terms, and one of them has kind of a non-trivial coefficient, and the other ones just have coefficient 1. Now, I want to mention that if you take the good reduction case, so if you replace KP with the maximal instead of the maximal compact instead of the instead of I, then you get the same for which is now the same as the semi-simple Lefschetz number, but where you use, instead of the Ewald-Hori-Heck algebra, you have the sort of spherical guy at P. So you have a spherical Heck algebra at P, and the phi j then is just equal to the characteristic function of a single double coset. So you take the g of zp to the j, that means the integers inside that qp to the j, times the single matrix, you have one matrix you can put there. Okay, so the point is that when you have bad reduction, the main thing that changes is that the function at p becomes more complicated, and in general it becomes a lot more complicated than this. It becomes quite complicated. But there is, so it's harder to study for that reason. Okay, so now let me give you the proof of this theorem. Okay. Is norm of delta the determinant? What? What?
How is gamma in this determined by
gamma? They are in this particular case, but in the general case, I didn't want to suppress the, I didn't want to sort of collapse the terminology too much, because if anyone tries to read Kawitz's papers on the symplectic group, you'll find this in there, and it's just a little bit better not to collapse things too much. But you're right. I mean, in some sense, because of special features of the group GL2 that don't occur for the general case. Yeah. Okay, so now let me remind you that what we're doing here is we're looking at a moduli problem in that case over there. We're looking at the fixed points of that moduli, the rational points in some moduli problem. So in other words, we're looking at certain concrete objects. Namely, we want to count objects that look like this, where we have some two elliptic curves now defined over a finite field, together with a degree p isogeny between them and some level structure, which is not so important. And these things are taken up to prime to p isogeny, but that's just a technical point. So what we want to do is count them. And the point is that these terms here, these things index isogeny classes of elliptic curves over fp to the j. So notice that these two guys are isogenous to each other, so you can consider the pair to live in a single isogeny class, and so we can kind of group them that way. And the terms here is simply the number of objects in a given isogeny class counted with the appropriate multiplicity of nearby traces, nearby cycles. So you count each object not once, but counted with multiplicity, the trace, the semi-simple trace of this Frobenius on the nearby cycles of this A of the element that you're interested in inside the given isogeny class. Okay, so now let's make it a little bit more precise. So what I want to say is that if you're giving me an isogeny class, I can give you some group theoretic elements, which I'm going to call gamma zero. And so how does that work? So this came up in Milne's lectures, where he was talking about ways that you might try to describe the points modulo p. And in the, it's like, this is like the baby version of the Langlands-Rappaport conjecture. Okay, this is the most basic, simple thing that we need to master to get started on anything in the subject. So, so basically, the idea is that if you give me an isogeny class of elliptic curves, let's say represented by E0, I can give you from that a semi-simple elliptic inside GL2Q. So this is up to conjugacy, so this is mod conjugacy, with a couple of properties. This isn't all the properties, but this is a couple of them. So first of all, what are the two properties I want to say? Well, first of all, I already said elliptic, so now there's only one property left. The determinant of gamma zero is equal to p to the j. So this is things over p over the finite field. So I kind of want to do it that way, where you classify things defined over a finite field and consider isogenies defined over that finite field. I mean, so what do you do here? You take E0 and you map it to any semi-simple gamma zero such that the characteristic polynomial of gamma zero is equal to the characteristic polynomial of the Frobenius of E0. So the Frobenius of E0, if you know about abelian varieties or elliptic curves over finite fields, that's an that thing can be defined by looking at Tate modules, but in any case, you can look at an L-adic Tate module, which is defined from the L torsion of the elliptic curve, and you can look at the Frobenius as an operator on the elliptic curve, which then, by functoriality, gives you an operator on the Tate module, and that's some rank 2 vector space, essentially. And you can look at the characteristic polynomial of that, and it turns out it has integer coefficients, and it's independent of the choice of L that you use for your L-adic Tate module. And so that's a well-defined this is a well-defined polynomial of degree 2 with integer coefficients, and the final coefficient is a Q, or it's a P to the J, is Q here. And so this thing, it gives you a map, and it's injective by Honda-Tate theory. So this is sort of implicit in, I mean, I'm just using some things that Milne discussed. And I don't, for the purposes of this, I don't need to understand exactly the image at this point. So there's certain conjugacy classes that arise from elliptic curves, and I don't need to worry about that. I just need to know that I have one. And then how do I get, I'm going to get gamma and delta in a sort of way of transferring the Frobenius actions on cohomology over to group elements acting on some vector spaces. So the point is E0 is an elliptic curve over a finite field, so it has a cohomology, it has various cohomology groups. So let me say, we get this pair as follows. So H, we can consider this module, which is the dual of the Tate module that Milne discussed. Anyway, it's just the product over all primes not equal to P of some cohomology group that you attach to E. And since you're over a finite field, to be technical here, you have to say L-adic or Itali cohomology. Okay, but it doesn't matter for the purposes of this. It's just some vector space, or it's some module, free module, over this ring of rank 2. And on here, the Frobenius acts here, so it's some automorphism, and I can just transfer that via a choice of isomorphism here over to some element gamma. So now gamma is an automorphism of this thing. In other words, it's an element of GL2 over this ring. Okay, now you can do a similar thing at the place P, but then you have to use some slightly, well, to be parallel here, I'm going to phrase it in terms of crystalline cohomology. So now you have a thing that's normally noted this way. You get some kind of object attached to E0, and it turns out it's just, again, a free of rank 2. It's a vector space dimension 2 over this. And, I mean, you don't really need to know what crystalline cohomology is. For people in the audience who know RE, it's another way to describe this in a more elementary way is to use the Dudenay module, or the p-divisible group attached to this. But anyway, it doesn't matter what it is, because for the purposes here, it's just the crystalline cohomology. It's just it's a vector space. This thing tensored with QP is just some vector space over QP, which has two operators, Frobenius and Verschiebung. So these guys act on there. And this one is a sigma linear bijection. And this one is a sigma inverse linear bijection. And they satisfy the relations that these two guys commute with each other, and their composition is just multiplication by P. So anyway, the point is that over here you have some kind of canonically defined sigma linear bijection, F, and you can transmit that over to just an automorphism of two-dimensional space, which is sigma linear. Way to write that is a normal matrix composed with sigma. So that acts on there sigma linearly. And as a final point here, it's one of the basic features of this is that F to the J is equal to the Frobenius. So what that means is that, well, F to the J is going to correspond to taking this guy to the J, Well, this guy to the J, if you think about it, is exactly the norm of delta. So the fact that, anyway, all those conditions I wrote on delta and gamma just follow from this discussion and the construction. Okay, so now how do we use this? Well, I want to do a warm-up case. So instead of doing, so to speak, the full story all at once, I'm just going to do a warm-up case. So we're going to try to count, remember, we're trying to count points with certain multiplicity, but let's simplify that in two ways. Let's count a different set that's not quite the same, and also let's forget about multiplicities. So in some sense, I'm just doing the good reduction question here. So this is a warm-up case. And it actually corresponds to, I mean, it's more or less the case of Kp equals maximal compact. So this time I really am just doing exactly what's in Kawitz's paper in a very baby version. So now let's consider the following number. I want to count not pairs, but just single elliptic curves defined over Fp to the J. And now let's forget about level structure. So no level structure here. So let's just be a little bit imprecise. Now I want to claim that we can get a good expression like the kind we want, write this number as kind of sum of orbital integrals in the following way. So first of all, I'm going to break things up by isogeny classes. So here we're going to sum first over isogeny classes. And then we're going to take the number of terms which correspond to a given isogeny class. And the good way to do that is to choose an isogeny for each object that you're looking at and then mod out by the things that are overlap, which is basically the automorphism group of the self-isogenies of E0. So we have a certain Q group, and then we have the set of all pairs of elliptic curves together with a choice of isogeny. So here we have an isogeny from E0 to E1. So we're counting the numbers of things in here, and this is the group of self-isogenies of E0, and a way to write that as an algebraic group is to think of it as the endomorphisms of E0 tensored with Q, and then you take the units in there. So that group, obviously, this set here is a torsor for this. It obviously acts by acting on these guys just by composition. And so now the point is that this is good because now we can express this number in a way that's more in terms of lattices. So now using that description over there, I'm going to rewrite this and sort of takes a lot of blackboard room, but I'll write it down here. Okay, so now we have the gamma zeros, which basically correspond to these guys, remember. There was a map from these guys into the set of gamma zeros. And now I'm going to write the cardinality of the set IQ acting now on a more complicated thing, which is, first of all, you look at the ZP hat lattices inside AP squared such that they're fixed by gamma. And then you take the product of that with ZP to the J lattices contained inside QP to the J squared. And let's call these things L sub P such that now I have to rewrite, there is a certain slightly worse thing than just being fixed by delta sigma. In fact, what happens here is that delta sigma of LP is contained inside LP and contains P. PLP. Okay, so how do I get such objects? Well, what I do is, if I'm given my elliptic curve, then I can associate to it its tape module, but with just integral coefficients. And then I can apply phi to that, and that will sort of, because the thing is contravariant on cohomology, it will give me an object inside this given vector space. So, in other words, here, what I get is phi of, I get an object in here by looking at phi of the cohomology of E1 with, so to speak, integral coefficients. And over here, I do a similar thing. I take phi attached to the crystalline cohomology group of E1, but I don't tensor with QPJ. So here I again have a lattice. And it turns out that this map from here to there is an isomorphism. That's not entirely obvious because you have to see, well, why is it true that giving lattices with one other thing I should mention. First of all, being fixed by gamma zero, by gamma here, that's the same as saying essentially that the isogeny is defined over the base field. I mean, this guy remembers the Frobenius of this, and Frobenius is sort of functorial in the sense that these things, Frobenius will act on both of them, and the diagram will commute. So essentially, what you get here is something that automatically has to be fixed by this gamma. And over here, well, you have this sort of more complicated thing. And what this means is that this thing is basically F. And when you take a lattice here, you automatically get a module under the ring generated by F and V and the integers. So that means that it's a lattice that has to be stable under F and V. Well, this is the condition that it's stable under F, and the condition that it's stable under V as well just boils down to this. Because this thing is actually just F times V or V times F, so you can see that this condition is satisfied. And the thing is that it's true that any kind of pairs of lattices like this come from an elliptic curve in the isogeny class, because to give an isogeny like this is nothing more than to give a finite group scheme inside E0, because giving the kernel of this map is the same as giving the map. And a finite group scheme, well, you can sort of see how like that's like going to break up in some sense as a product over all different primes of some finite group schemes. And here you're sort of capturing the part of the group scheme that has order prime to P, and here you're kind of capturing the part that's P. But, I mean, to really explain that, I have to go in more into Dudenay module theory, and I don't want to do that. So, anyway, so now we're almost done, because, you see, when you're counting lattices, that's basically like writing down an orbital integral. So that came up in Kautwitz's lectures. If you think about it, when you if you write down an orbital integral over a group, let me just say this briefly. So just note that let's look at this thing here first. Suppose we look just at the most baby case of this. This simply is the number of cosets G such that gamma G is equal to this. In other words, it's just another way of writing that it's fixed, that this is a coset which is fixed by gamma. That happens because the conjugacy class of gamma, this thing is exactly counting, so to speak, how many cosets you can put here so that the conjugacy class meets this. And that's the same as saying that this is true, which is the same as saying that the corresponding lattice, G times the standard lattice, is fixed by gamma. So in the similar reasoning applied to not the identity function, not the characteristic function of this, but of the congruent subgroup. And similarly, looking at, there's several other complications that come in, because we're not just looking at lattices, but we're looking, so to speak, at classes under this thing. But anyway, the thing that comes out is, so after some work, you get the following thing, that this thing is also equal to the sum of these gamma zeros. And now, and I want to use the fact that when you embed I into these automorphisms of the Adelic space and of QP to the J, you get something very concrete. So here you get, so you get this thing, and here you get just the centralizer of gamma. So what you get here is simply the volume and then times the orbital integral of the, there's no level structure here, so I'm just putting the identity. And now the twisted orbital integral of that spherical guy that I mentioned before. So the reason that this comes in is essentially this calculation. The reason that this comes in is because you're looking at lattices which are in a certain relative position with respect to delta sigma applied to the lattice. And this relative position is captured by this matrix right here. So that's it for the warm-up case. And now all I'm going to say is that in the general case, it's similar. So now, let me just explain what the differences are that come up in the general case when you actually have level n structure, and when you actually have some kind of Iwahori level structure instead of the. I mean, when you're counting pairs, that's like the Iwahori level structure. So now, for the cardinality of pairs like this, together with level structure defined over the finite field. So you replace it just becomes this thing because we've added level n structure. And but it's more complicated with what happens at P. So for the twisted orbital integral, we're going to put in a different function now. So we need to count with multiplicity ZP lattice chains now. Which look like, well, they look like this, and they sit inside QP to the J. The way these things arise is that you have your pair, E1 to E2, and you apply to that thing, you get phi attached to the crystalline cohomology, but it's order reversing, so now you get the crystalline cohomology of this. This is some lattice which maps in the other direction. This way. So this is this lattice and this is this lattice. And the fact that this is a degree P isogeny means that the co-kernel of this thing is killed by P. So what you can do is you can replace I mean, it's just more convenient to think of it the following way. Let's capture this data in another way that's equivalent. You write L2 is equal to the image of L2. So now this is something sitting inside L1, which is the same as bold L1. So now what I'm claiming is now we're looking at certain lattice chains. And they're in a certain relative position when you apply Frobenius to that lattice chain. So now we get the following thing. Okay, so so what we're looking at now is, I want to say that we're going to count, but actually we're not going to count, but we're going to count with multiplicity. The first thing is just to understand the set. So we're basically looking at the number of objects that look like this. They're lattice chains, which consist of L0 contained inside L1, contained inside P inverse of L0. It's contained inside there because, like I said, the co-kernel is killed by P. Okay? Such that the lattice chain is contained inside not equal to the Frobenius of the lattice chain, which is contained in a not equal to the P times the lattice chain. So this is just the chain version of this right here. And to write it all out, what you get is an object that looks like this. L0 inside L1, inside P inverse L0. Then you have Frobenius of that. And actually, instead of Frobenius, let me write delta sigma. So delta sigma of L0 contained inside delta sigma L1 contained in not equal. And then you have delta sigma of P inverse L0. Contained in not equal, and then you have PL0 contained in PL1 contained in L0. Okay, so now what we have here is an object that's entirely in terms of linear algebra. And these objects arise in other things, and they're called, so this you think of this as a single object here, a lattice chain. So that's something inside the affine flag variety. And in fact, it's called a Dehlin-Lustig, affine Dehlin-Lustig variety. It's like the Dehlin-Lustig varieties that come up in the study of finite groups of Lie type, but instead of being attached to a finite group and a finite vowel group, it's attached to a loop group, and in some sense you can think of that as a p-adic group, and an affine vowel group. So it's like the affine analog of Dehlin-Lustig varieties. And in any case, that's a concrete object, and functions on affine flag varieties are like elements in Iwohori-Heck algebras, at least as long as they're, I mean, I should say that this is roughly speaking G of QP to the J mod the Iwohori for P to the J. And you can actually think of it as either the function field version or the p-adic version here. So if you're more used to thinking of affine flag varieties for the function field, that's perfectly okay here. It's basically equivalent. This particular kind of thing. Okay, and now, so now what we want to do is understand something about the points. I mean, so we want to understand this set, and the thing is that the subgroup. I mean, there's another way to think of this. There's a map from this set to the following set of objects. So you have, remember, we have our standard lattice chain, lambda 0 inside lambda 1 inside P inverse lambda 0, and you can consider objects that lie in the same relative position here, but with respect to the standard lattice chain. And this is something I'm going to call, which you'll understand later why, M loc And so here this is the standard lattice chain, so to speak, over this for this field. So that I wrote down before when I defined parahoric subgroup, I wrote down some vector space, some free modules over some ring of integers, and P is a uniformizer in this situation. So basically looking at chains that are in a fixed relative position with respect to the standard guy. And true here is that, I mean, the Iwahori subgroup, which is fixing this chain here by definition, is going to act on this set of lattice chains. Okay? And in fact, what you get here is not a well-defined, so the map here that you want, would like to put here, I should say, is that any lattice chain L dot can be written as some G times the standard lattice chain. I mean, the group G, this group here, acts transitively on the set of all lattice chains. For GLN, you can just see that by linear algebra. You can do it in exercise. Okay? So what you can do is you can map, you can write some G, which is not uniquely determined, but is uniquely determined up to an element here, which will fix the lattice chain. You can write that, you can take that to G inverse delta sigma of G times the standard lattice chain. And this is not well-defined, but it is well-defined up to, so to speak, the orbit, the action of the Iwahori. So what you do is you get a well-defined map from this set to at least the strata, the I orbits inside here. And this a good name for this map is, maybe become clear later why I call it this way, is isocrystal. Because it's defined using isocrystals of elliptic curves. And there's another map which we'll see maybe later. Certainly will occur in my manuscript, which is called crystal, because it's defined using crystals instead of isocrystals. Anyway, the point is now this M-loc thing is actually a very concrete object which sits inside the affine flag variety and can be described explicitly. So M-loc is actually something defined over the whole ring of integers, in this case, in fact, it's can be thought of as over FP, and it what we've drawn here is actually rather the special fiber. So this would be like the FP to the J points, and I'm going to talk more about this later. But the point is that it's something sitting. I mean, it's a kind of deformation, which in the special fiber. So this is now spec of ZP. We have two P1s meeting each other transversely at a point. So this is over P. And then you have the generic part here. And there it's just a P1. So you have some kind of deformation like that. And now I'm just going to go over 2 minutes. Now the point is that the function that, remember what we're trying to do is count these points with multiplicity. What I claim is that you can, that the multiplicity here only depends on the image of this map. Okay? And then hopefully that will become clear next time. But, so the basic point, the fact I'm going to use now So the facts are, well, first of all, the I orbits in M correspond to the three matrices. So these I orbits can be indexed by certain matrices, and they're exactly the ones that I wrote down before. And the orbit corresponding to this is one-dimensional. In fact, it's an A1. This one is also one-dimensional, and it's an A1. And this one here is zero-dimensional. It's a point. So that's why the special fiber looks like this. And this is just a linear algebra problem. It's kind of completely elementary to justify these statements, so I'm not going to do it, but it's not a big deal. This is supposed to be the easy part somehow of the work. Now the other fact is that this map isocrystal let me put it this way. The semi-simple trace of Frobenius at the nearby cycles depends only on the image of X under isocrystal. And then, now the point is that since this is true, the twisted orbital integral, the number with multiplicity that we're trying to compute, is going to be equal to the twisted orbital integral of some linear combination of the three functions. The characteristic functions of these three guys. And the point is that the coefficients come because you can actually compute the nearby cycles. So now it turns out that locally, this is a set theoretic map, but you can kind of make it algebraic. And then what it turns out to be the case the coefficients are as stated in the theorem, because one knows a basic fact about deformations of this type is that you can actually compute explicitly the nearby cycles at a point, and the most interesting point is this one, so let's call it that. So the stalk there of such a deformation like this is given by just the constant sheaf QL for I equals 0, and it's QL tape twisted by minus 1 if I is 1. So when you take the alternating trace of Frobenius on this, you get a factor of 1 from this, and then you get, when the first cohomology thing, you subtract the trace of Frobenius on this, so you get a minus P to the J. Okay? So I'll give some more references that are relevant to this next time, and also I'll discuss the general theory of local models next time.